Produced by Jeffrey Grisselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, VR Hoisington, and Wayne Hall, this is Yes Music Podcast episode 386. What did they do next? Part 3A, Bill Bruford.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 386 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulryan, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later on. You can always get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site yesmusicpodcast.com. This week we have the first part of our next What Did They Do Next series, and we're considering Dr. Bill Bruford and his unexpected move to King Crimson to record Lark's Tongues in Aspic. Mark and I kick off the topic in a few moments. On Facebook this week, there's been a lot of content about the current Royal Affair tour, as you'd expect, including the progressive Palaver guys attending the show in White Plains, New York. They appear to have been impressed, so do look out for their coverage of that on their show. Mark received a positive review of his Mark Anthony Kay and the Lower Third Collective, the four-song EP, from our friends at Something Else Reviews. Well, actually, Preston Frazier. And Preston also reviews Love Shine from Open Your Eyes. Daniel Crone had a fantastic time at the Royal Affair tour and posted a short reactions review. And Mark shared a rather upsetting report about Air Studios in Montserrat, where most of the 30-year-old This Week ABWH album was recorded. It was abandoned when a volcano erupted on the Caribbean island, and it's in a terrible state now. Maybe someone will conserve it. I hope so. It was Alan White's 70th birthday this week, and there were lots of posts about it, including my favourite, which was Jeff Downes and Alan holding a large Roger Dean print of the painting from the front cover of the White Band album. A wonderful gift from Roger, as sent to me by Brady Queen. In the visitor posts, Jeffrey Mason added a review of a concert on the Royal Affair tour, and Gary Matthews shared the video you may have seen of the six-year-old boy playing a piano version of South Side of the Sky. It's definitely worth another view. Bob Keeley is very excited that a John Anderson show has been announced in Grand Rapids, so he can go and see John solo for the first time. And over on Twitter, at White Rhino T, was at one of the Royal Albert Hall King Crimson gigs with a certain Trevor Horn. Trading Boundaries, Keith Hoisington and Dave Watkins are rather taken with the new Roger Dean Valentino high fashion shirts. And in fact, he's done a complete collection of clothing based on Roger Dean's work. Maybe the band will be wearing them soon. And Simon Barrow shared the Yes 50 live album artwork. There's also a decent promotional video for the album, Doing the Rounds, which was spotted by Brady Queen, amongst others. Brian Dilly pointed out that all the Royal Affair tour merchandise, including the tour book, is available on merchbar.com. But I still don't know what a koozie is. Anyone? Lots of tweets appeared from the tour, including some interesting behind-the-scenes shots from Jeff Downes and his assertion that he thinks he was the first person to take a Fairlight sampler on tour. Michael Handahan attended the first Royal Affair show, and here's what he thought of it. It was a great show, he says. They were right on and tight. Steve is amazing, and that high note he hits in the guitar riff during Siberian Katru, when the vocals start, he nailed every time with his pinky. What's the phrase, pinky power? Steve also sped up parts of Sketches in the Sun at a rather intense and frantic pace. I don't think I've heard him play that intensely before. The new Onward is stupendous. A new short intro was added and Jay brought the drums into the mix shortly after that. Jeff plays so well and I'm really appreciating his talents more with each passing year. He and Steve blend so well together it sometimes reminds me of the polyphonic synthesizer sound. Believe this or not, Steve was seriously getting into Rhythm of Love and this threw me off a bit. He really found that Rabin style in the song, but you still know it's Steve. In a way, it was a compliment to Trevor. The Gates of Delirium was played with precision and power. It was getting ever so close to their performance of Gates way back in 2000 at Holmdel NJ, my favourite Yes show, and on YouTube. They really need to get John into the battle scene with some incidentals. Perhaps he was off to the side doing something, but it's easy to recognise the recorded effects from the Relayer album. I didn't notice anything on top of the effects that was not covered by the four players, but then again, Imagine was a genuine treat, and I really think it would be a great single in its unedited longer concert version. It is that good. The world certainly needs to hear the message again, especially here in the US. I hope it pops up on YouTube. I'd be very interested in your thoughts on Imagine. Well, listen to last week's episode. Oh yes, and though Alan is still having his issues, he still plays well and found a true comrade in Jay. If you look again at the set list, the band really jammed. Even the three slower songs were picked up just a bit in tempo. They seem different this year as far as their presence. Not their presence as with location or place, but rather a presence as with the nature of the music. It's like they're chasing the sound again. I hope that made sense. Indeed it did. Thank you very much indeed, Michael. Brilliant to hear that you enjoyed yourself. And Michael also spotted a link on Rick Wakeman's website of a limited edition 100-unit pressing of Beyond the Planets. It'll be clear vinyl and each hand numbered and signed by Rick, so take a look at that if you're interested. Great comments once again on the show notes for last week's episode from Brady Queen, Dave Watkinson, Miguel Falcao, Barry Gorski, Stephen Lamb and Dave Owen. Do go and have a read of those. As always, thank you very much indeed to everyone who got in touch this week in any way.
I've an All Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says. I've an All Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says.
So this week we have got a conversation about the next person to leave Yes after Tony Kay and One Live Badger last time, which really enjoyed finding out about some fascinating things about that, but no more fascinating than when Bill Bruford left the band, and Mark is with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. So this is our new way of doing this, as you should be quite used to now. So this week we're going to talk about some general things about what happened when Bill Bruford left the band after Close to the Edge and what he did next. And then we're going to listen to the first proper project, the first album that he did after leaving Yes, and we're going to do that in detail on a forthcoming episode. I won't say that it's next week because we've got quite a few things coming up which you'll really enjoy in the coming weeks. But anyway, so we're talking Bill Bruford, Dr. Bill Bruford now, and I was absolutely delighted to meet him, as you'll probably remember. Last year it is now, on the 50th anniversary of the start of the band, down in that very, very hot basement in London, where we're unveiling that. Bill unveiled the plaque to Yes. So someone I've actually met, we're talking about now. Isn't that wonderful? Anyway, so I was thinking about the way Bill Bruford left, and in fact, he was the first person to leave of his own accord. The two previous people, that's Peter Banks and Tony Kay, were asked to leave, but Bill was the first who took it on himself to leave. And the first thing I wanted to just read out, actually, is from Bill's autobiography, because two paragraphs there are very, very revealing, I think, about what he said later. Obviously, he wrote the autobiography much later than when he did leave, but interesting to see what he says about it now. He says, "Why would I want to leave this organisation on the brink of its international success? It's the obligation of every artist to exercise his or her higher sensibilities so far as much as time as possible, of the time as possible, and with Yes, I knew I could go no further. Repetition follows popular success like night follows day. Drummer Alan White was already available as a suitable replacement and, essential for me, would ensure the continuation of the group." Interesting. "If I didn't want to troll around the world stadiums playing Close to the Edge, now was the time to say so. And there was a very appealing alternative. I'd been stalking Robert Fripp of the sensational King Crimson for a while, and he had finally conceded to the badgering," interesting use of words, "of this over-praised ingenue. He waited until, like a ripening tomato, I just fell off the vine. King Crimson, a darker and more mysterious organisation altogether, would offer another level in musical education for this drummer, so eager for knowledge and so protective of his sensibilities." And then the last sentence I wanted to read as well of this chapter, which is, "I loved Yes, but I thirsted to learn more, and I was ready to change the world with King Crimson." So absolutely fascinating. I mean, clearly from that, he is happy to say that he loved his time with Yes, and fascinating that maybe he wouldn't have left even if Alan White wasn't there, ready to take Yes onward, because he didn't want to see the end of Yes. That wasn't why he was leaving. He didn't want to break up the band.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, though, that he mentioned something that I've heard quite a few different musicians mention before, is that they felt that their contribution had come to an end in the band. And that, you know, when he mentioned that Close to the Edge was probably as far as he could go creatively with Yes, I always found that fascinating, because when you listen to it, Close to the Edge, I mean, there's some absolutely brilliant drumming that he does on there, of course. But when I compare it to King Crimson material, he definitely goes to the next level with his drumming there, and all kinds of different sorts of percussion that he uses and stuff like that. He definitely branches out a lot more in that way. But I find it interesting that he didn't think that he could do those sorts of things with Yes, because if you take a look at what ended up happening with Yes, like with Tales from Topographic Oceans and other things, they started bringing in all this crazy percussion. Like John Anderson had a whole percussion station at one point, for him. So it's not like those kind of things couldn't have happened with Bill, but it's interesting that he thought that, you know, he had come to a like a brick wall with his creativity with Yes.
Yeah, and I think it had a lot to do with his sort of jazz sensibilities, although I do question, I mean, I don't know enough about it, but I can understand why he would be tempted by what Robert Fripp was doing, because it appeared to be freer and more exploratory and improvisational and so on. I don't know if it was. Someone who knows a lot more about King Crimson would have to tell me that. But also fascinating is Martin Popoff quotes John Anderson's reaction to Bill Bruford leaving, and this is what he says. "I was devastated when Bill said he was leaving, because I thought we'd really together made one of the most wonderful adventurous pieces, Close to the Edge. I would never have believed that we could do the Close to the Edge album, that kind of music. So I was on cloud 9, and I quickly descended to cloud 2 when he said he was leaving. And he went to join King Crimson. And I thought, well, can't you get off on being in Yes and get the same energy, which is what you just said, Mark? And he said, nope, I just can't. It's not free enough for me. So it was really tough." So exactly what you were saying, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, the interesting part of it when you said that, you know, somebody to input whether you think it is more freer and more stuff, you know, more availability to explore more. I think it is. I mean, I have quite a lot of their box sets and stuff like that. And I even have the Lark's Tongue and Aspect box set that came out not long, well, a few years ago, actually. But when you take a look at their live shows that they did, one thing that's very apparent that's like different immediately from Yes is that they always do in their shows at least once or twice a complete improv, just right off the cuff. Like there's no structure to it. They just start playing and they just do a piece and it ends up either, you know, segueing into another song or it just stops altogether. And that's something that they've done for quite a while, like back in the day. I mean, I have so many different examples of it on there. And even when they did this television appearance, when they first got Bill into the band, there's like a 30-minute piece on video of them playing just something spontaneously off the cuff, and for that long too. So, I mean, I can understand what he means by having more freedom to just experiment, because I can't imagine Yes ever just dropping into a full form experimental piece like that.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, that with the influence of people like Howe and Wakeman in particular, I think you've always got a structure, haven't you? And that was one of the things that Bill disliked intensely about the recording sessions for Close to the Edge, wasn't it? That he was pretty bored, really, as they worked out each note. I mean, it's the opposite, isn't it, of a kind of jazz improvisation. But interesting that he goes to King Crimson. And, of course, you know, a bit like the Beatles and the Beach Boys, they were always very much in competition with each other, I think. And nobody's pretending that they weren't. There was a certain amount of rivalry between those bands. And you can imagine it, because going on the tour that I did last year of all those different places in London, they're physically so close to each other. All the bands knew each other. All the musicians knew each other very, very well. And in fact, I found a bit in Will Romano's book, which is all about Close to the Edge, where he suggests another reason, in fact, why Bill chose King Crimson. And he says, "Maybe a more practical reason that he left can be sought for why Bruford joined Fripp. Fripp was actually crashing, living with, Bruford at his home in London for a short time prior to the drummer accepting Fripp's invitation. Crimson had also shared a bill with Yes a few times, most recently in Boston. And so, as I say, I mean, they were living in each other's pockets, really, all these bands and these different musicians. So he knew Fripp very, very well from living with him. And I think I read elsewhere in Romano's book that the two of them discussed jazz. And interestingly, I think from reading between the lines of what they were saying, Bill Bruford knew some jazz, but he didn't know anything like the kind of depth and different kinds of jazz and different kinds of music that Robert Fripp knew. And I get the impression that Fripp was a real musical intellectual. I mean, and that must have appealed to Bruford.
Yeah, I think that was absolutely one of the main reasons why this happened, because once you're in somebody's sphere of influence, then it's really easy to have something like that happen. I mean, like you said, when they start talking about jazz and stuff like that, it obviously, you know, appeal to his sensibility. And I know that when you look back at some of the past documentaries with Yes, that's one of the things that Bill Bruford noticed about Yes when they first joined them, is that they were talking about things like, you know, the Beach Boys and, yeah, you know, Fifth Dimension and stuff like that. Yeah. And he was like, wow, like, he goes, like, this is nothing like what he was interested in, but yet they made it work, right?
Yeah.
So now that he meets Robert Fripp and they start talking about all the kinds of things that he likes and even stuff that's far beyond the stuff that he likes, and he starts learning about, you know, different branches of jazz music and stuff like that. Obviously, he wants to be involved with this man. Yeah. And so when he gets the opportunity to come in and join the band, I mean, it's very, to me, it just seems very obvious that he was influenced that way to come and join. I mean, I think Robert Fripp once even said too that he thought that Bill was quote unquote ready now to join King Crimson.
Yes, I've read that as well recently. And fascinating, though, as Romano points out in his book, that of course this is the second time that King Crimson tempted a Yes member out, if you want to put it that way. Well, certainly it's further example of the way that they were so close to each other, these bands, and that's John Anderson guesting on vocals on the King Crimson album Lizard, which he did before this point. But something else that Romano says I was fascinated by was that Giles and MacDonald, two of the founders of King Crimson, founder members, left King Crimson stating similar reasons to Bruford leaving Yes. They said that they had gone as far as they could musically with King Crimson and felt they couldn't grow musically, and that's when they decided to move on as well, which is absolutely fascinating. But what came out of this, of course, is Lark's Tongues in Aspic, and we've already mentioned it. And my story with this is that somehow I managed to make a link, and back in those days, as you know, we only had the press, there was no internet or anything to go by, but I somehow made a link between King Crimson and Yes, I think probably by looking through albums in a record shop and noticing Bill Bruford's name on the back of a King Crimson album. I'm sure that's how it happened. It was no more involved than that. And Lark's Tongues in Aspic was the first piece of King Crimson music I ever heard, and I absolutely loved it. Although I do have to say, and we'll come back to listening to it properly in the next of these episodes, but I do have to say that it took me quite some time to get my head round, particularly Lark's Tongues in Aspic, part one, and then part two on the B side. It really, really struggled to get into that, and it did take many, many listens. But the reason I think it's important music, progressive music for me, is that I did take the time. I didn't just abandon it like I've abandoned other types of music in the past. Mm-hmm. I kept listening to it because I knew there was stuff going on there which was absolutely fascinating. And it's an amazing album, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And it's funny how I kind of got into it, because I had two introduction points to it. One was my drummer back in my old band was a big collector of Modern Drummer magazine.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a little section about Bill Bruford in there, and they were talking about all the different bands he was in. And I remember reading, you know, with this King Crimson band. I'm like, I kind of put that in the back of my mind, like, maybe I should check that out sometime. And then what really kicked it off was I had gotten the Yes Years VHS cassette. Yes, VHS.
Ah, yeah.
And I had watched it, and there's a quick, like, 10, 15 second segment of Easy Money that they played live on there. And I was like, wow, this is kind of interesting. And it was really, like, distorted, the music. Like, it wasn't the greatest audio recording of it, but just seeing him there with that kind of drum set and all these gongs behind him, I'm like, what is this all about, you know?
Yes.
And I was kind of captivated by it. And then within the next couple of weeks, I had bought the 30th anniversary CD version of Lark's Tongues and Aspect. And right from there, I was immediately hooked, because just like you, I had, you know, it took a little while to get around Lark's Tongue Part 1. I was kind of like, what's going on here?
That's right.
Then when they started playing stuff like Easy Money, and, you know, they had other songs in there that kind of were more easy enough to digest. Like, that's the one thing that I thought that was very smart of them, is that they made complicated songs, but they also had like Book of Saturday and Exiles. And then they had really interesting parts too, like the Talking Drum, which is a really interesting instrumental piece. And then, of course, the main piece that everybody seems to remember from this album, which is Lark's Tongue Part 2. It has that kind of signature riff at the beginning that everybody interested in, like, right away knows what that is. But that was my introduction, was really thanks to Yes, I got into King Crimson.
Well, that's interesting parallel with the way I found it as well. And it immediately appealed to me for other reasons than you've mentioned. For example, the violin. David Cross plays a violin on it, and I was a violinist, so I was absolutely fascinated to see that there. And in fact, on the back of this, when I've got the 30th anniversary CD edition like you as well. And he plays violin, viola and mellotron on this. And of course, John Wetton, and I had no idea about the connections between Yes and John Wetton at that time either.
Yeah, there's definitely quite a few connections when you really dig deep into it later, right? But it is quite a fascinating record. And like you said, the one thing that I liked about it too is that, unlike some albums that you can get into right away and digest quite easily, this required repeated listening, I thought. And the more you listen to it, the more you kind of pick out new things. I mean, the one thing that I really love about the box set that I got is there's a devoted DVD segment to it that you can get in there, and it breaks down a lot of different things in there. There's like a segment where it's just studio outtakes where they have them playing like Lark's Tongue, and it's just Jamie Muir and the violinist, for example, David Cross, and they're just playing sections of the song together. So when they, you never really notice these sections until they split them up, let you hear them separately, and then when all of a sudden they come and play that section full band, you're like, oh, wait a minute, now I hear that part all of a sudden. You know,
fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And that's one of my key memories of King Crimson and of progressive music generally, is the video. Now, I think I did see it on the television first, but the video of Lark's Tongues in Aspect Part 2 and what Jamie Muir was doing. And I've always been fascinated to see Jamie Muir on that video and Bill Bruford playing, well, I don't know if you can call it together. They were sort of battling each other at various points, I think. But I wonder what Bill Bruford thought of Jamie Muir. And I'm sure there are plenty of people out there that will be able to tell me the answer. But that was something, I mean, going from Yes and the precision of getting every note right and playing it the same each night. And then you've got Jamie Muir on stage with you doing, just going absolutely crazy. It must have been quite a culture shock.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because I remember reading a few times, or even in these in the books that come with these box sets, that one of the things that Bill Bruford admired about Jamie Muir was the fact that he could be so free. Like, he said that it was he was doing things on stage that he couldn't possibly imagine himself doing. Like, he was going out there blowing all these whistles on stage, and blowing these little bicycle horns, and he said that even he they would do this section of a song where he would take a bag of leaves and start throwing them in the air by the microphones for sound effect. And he's like, how did he even think of these things? That's the thing that really fascinated, you know, Bill about Jamie's, that how he could branch out his mind to do these different things for the music.
Absolutely. Well, I'm really looking forward to listening to it again. I've not listened to this album for some time, and to, you know, spending some time with it as we will be doing. And I do. I'm looking at the CD here and looking at the back here, and songs like Book of Saturday are just so, I just find them so beautiful. Such lovely pieces of work. I'm really looking forward to listening to it and then talking about it. I'm just fascinated, finally, that recorded at Command Studios London in January and February 1973. Gosh, it's quite something. All right. So looking forward to, very much to what we say about that when we come back in part two of this episode. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Hello, this is Patrick Moraz, and you are listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Just before we go, here's half the patron update, and hopefully it's the other half from last time. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, V.R. Hoisington and Wayne Hall. And Yes Music Podcast patrons are Mark James Lang, Martin Kjellberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Peter Herndon, Lobate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Zarkol-Bags, Robert Naser, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Stephen Lamb, Steve Dill, Steve Perry, Steve Rode, Steve Scott, Stephen Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, Tony Handley, Joseph Cottrell, Keith Hoisington, and William Hayes. Continued thanks to Robert and David, of course. Now, if you're a patron and you haven't checked out the most recent video on the site, two winners were announced for this month's Book of the Month, but neither of them have contacted me yet. So have a look and see if those are you, and I'll get that book off to you as soon as I can. So thank you very much indeed to all patrons. If you'd like to join them in helping to support the show financially, as well as having access to lots of exclusive content and activities, head over to Patreon, patreon.com/YesMusicPodcast, or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. We'll be back next week with some very interesting things from John Kirkman. However, in the meantime, you can follow the show via Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.